so we're running. Okay, so my guest today is Dr. Nigel Mather. He's an honorary fellow at the University of Kent, and he's going to be talking about his new book that he's currently writing at the moment, published by Manchester University Press, which is entitled...
The title is Love in a Damp Climate, Sex and Desire in British Films of the 2000s.
And that's a follow-up, isn't it, to your book, Tears of Laughter, British Comedy Drama in the 1990s, is that correct?
That's right, yes. I mean, this time there seemed maybe a little bit less laughter, perhaps, and more tears. But the title comes from a chapter in Raymond Dernyak's book, A Mirror for England, British Movies from Affluence to Anxiety, 1945 to 1970. And the title, I should be honest, has given me a few problems, really, because I'm conscious, Love in a Damp Climate, we did have an extraordinary kind of summer last year, really, you know. So I did wonder from that point of view whether something like Love's Labour's Loss might work a little bit better or whatever. And having kind of sex in the title, it alludes a little bit to John Hill's Sex, Class and Realism, but also the publishers are quite keen because they felt it, you know, might enhance the sales a little bit, really. I mean, that remains to be seen. And desire is in because it's a very broad term, and it kind of covers social desires, individual desires, and obviously sexual desires. And when I was growing up, I mean, you're probably too young to remember this, really, but the TV Times magazine used to have an advertisement on the television, and there'd be a list of all the contents in the magazine, and they would close by saying, "I never knew there was so much in it." And I've tried with this book, really, to have a series of chapters looking at very much love and desire and sex and society from a number of kind of different perspectives. So one chapter is looking at biographies of esteemed, sometimes rather controversial writers, but how films have depicted their personal lives as opposed to or connected with the literary life. So the figures such as John Keats, Jane Austen, and then more recent writers such as Sylvia Plath, Andrea Dunbar, and Oscar Wilde. And Wilde obviously, in a sense, has to be in there, really. And interesting, that chapter has been as to how these writers drew upon maybe their own experiences for the novels and plays, but also what kind of relationships and what kind of fulfilment they found in British society. And as it happens, a number of these writers, and I think this raises interesting questions about love and desire in British culture, to some extent had unhappy lives. Keats fell in love with a woman, young woman living next door to him, but their romance was tragically cut short by Keats dying in his early 20s. Dickens, for a while, was a happily married man with 10 young children, but then fell in love with somebody else. There's some suggestion he tried to have his wife put in a mental asylum, but he didn't succeed in that. And he also had, you know, something of an early death. Sylvia Plath, it's kind of well known, came to Britain from America, but had a kind of unhappy, in the end, rather tragic relationship with a fellow poet, Ted Hughes. Adrian Dunbar and Clara Barnard from Kent has made a film about this particular writer's life. She wrote Rita Sue and Bob Too, a kind of tragic comedy film, which kind of ends in comedy, but Dunbar's life certainly ended in tragedy. And the film about Oscar Wilde's life with Rupert Everett, that covers the last 2 years of Wilde's life, when he went to France having been released from prison. And that makes a case for, in fact, his life being almost as big a hell as he got when he got out of prison as, in fact, it was when he was incarcerated. So I think all these, I mean, you know, to some extent, that could be a book in itself, really. But all these writers that I think raise interesting questions about relationship between fiction and truth, history and biography, and also, you know, how these lives are presented. So that would be a historical look at Love and Desire. And then the next chapter is titled The Way We Live Now, and that looks at films that are very much concerned, in a sense, with modern Britain, contemporary Britain. And I've tried to find films that, in some cases, are contrasting. So Noel Clarke made, well, he made a trilogy of films, but I think from the point of view of your book, the two most interesting are Kiddlehood and Adulthood, which look at the lives of young people growing up in modern London and their relationships. Mm-hmm. And you know, the films touch on, you know, quite a number of themes, often, you know, very alarming themes, but sometimes with humour and sometimes, I think, with, you know, a very idiosyncratic way of looking at relationships. I then contrast them with two films that Joanna Hogg has made, which are centred around very different kind of characters, very much middle-class English characters, and their holidays abroad and their relationships abroad. And they provide an opportunity for a kind of middle-class cinema, really. And Hogg is keen for the middle classes to also be represented in these films. She sometimes thinks, you know, their lives are not seen as fit subjects for social realism, therefore are kind of neglected.
And so it's like a social realism for the middle classes. That's her argument.
It is a little bit of her argument. I mean, she's a kind of experimental filmmaker as well, really. I mean, her background was actually, you know, television, things like Casualty and EastEnders. But she's made dramas about... The first film that we're looking at is called Unrelated, and that's about a woman whose marriage is in difficulties, and she goes to Tuscany to spend some time with a friend who's invited her. But she becomes very much drawn into the lives of the teenagers, the sons and daughters of the people who invited her. And this leads to unhappy situations, in a way, really, because she's seen, I think, by the people who invited her as somebody who is trying to be young. And I think it raises interesting questions, again, I suppose, about the generation gap in terms of Love and Desire. I suppose the idea, you know, middle-aged people don't necessarily want to grow old. And also, I suppose, how people from different generations do kind of relate to each other and so on, you know. And she does a very good follow-up film called Archipelago, which is set in one of the isles of Sicily, a much kind of colder environment. And that's also about a family who are unhappy with each other, who have unhappy relationships. And one of the striking things about these two films, in a way, is that there's a lot of dark and tragic things in Noel Clarke's films, but one could argue that, in fact, in these two films by Joanna Hogg, that ultimately it seems even darker still at times. You know, it's a little bit hard to believe, but I think that is really what comes over in these films. So they provide, I think, you know, Kiddlehood, Adulthood, Unrelated, Archipelago, interesting points of contrast as well. Another subsection of this chapter involves films by directors who are not regularly employed in British cinema. And these would include Woody Allen's films, particularly Match Point and You'll Meet a Tall Dark Stranger. Films that maybe already been a little bit forgotten. I mean, you know, Allen has a very complicated trajectory, which, you know, his films have been produced. But his career was revitalised by coming to Britain. So I think there's an interest from that point of view that he did come at a time, really in the 2000s, when, you know, British identity was changing. It's a kind of post-Labour, post-Brown, Blair environment and so on. And he's very much viewing, you know, British culture from a kind of outside perspective. And a fellow American, Mike Nichols, came to do Closer, which is, you know, obviously a film we could perhaps talk about later, because I know you've seen that quite recently, really, about kind of, in that case, Anglo-American relationships. There was a Polish director, Paweł Palikowski, came to do a wonderful film called My Summer of Love, a film that made Emily Blunt a star, set in the north of England. And there's a director associated with the Dogma movement, a Danish director called Lone Scherfig, who made two films, an education one day, one set in the 1960s, one set in the 1990s. And, you know, also presenting British culture from a different kind of perspective. So I think there is a fascination there, I think, with somebody who's got a kind of new outlook, new perspective.
And would you call these films British films? Something like Matchpoint or the Woody Allen films, or even Closer, would you call that a British movie?
Well, that's a good question, really. And Raymond Dernyat, in his book, On a Mirror for England, he sort of took the view, well, if it's kind of set in Britain, if it's set with British themes, if it feels British, it's British and kind of legitimate for his discussions. And I would take a kind of similar view. I mean, there are examples at the time that the UK Film Council had particular conditions as to whether a film, you know, was actually officially designated as British. I've kind of taken the view because, you know, certainly some of these films, if you look at who's behind it at the very beginning, I mean, you know, it is very often an American company, which is why I've kind of taken Dernyat's view. And I think sometimes with the British film industry, it is, as a professor of film studies once said recently, it is something of a cottage industry compared to the American industry. So to that extent, perhaps it needs all the help it can get a little bit, really, you know. So I am happy to include these as, you know, maybe Anglo-American films, which, you know, still I think have something, you know, or maybe even perhaps particularly for that reason, something interesting to say, you know, about British culture.
I think Nichols is an interesting, because from what I've read, his involvement only came in at the directing stage. He's almost like a director for hire, I think, on Closer. And obviously the source material's from Patrick Marber's play.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the distinction is. It seemed to me very theatrical, I think, particularly in the staging of the dialogue scenes.
Yeah.
And I wasn't wholly kind of convinced or even, I have to say, particularly entertained.
You think it should have been called Colder?
I think it's very kind of it's very kind of these kind of middle class people talking about these weighty themes, you know, using these sometimes quite contrived moments, like the lap dance scene, or somebody having a photograph taken of them, or somebody in a doctor's office. These contrived scenes, very, very theatrical and not particularly successful. Yes. I personally didn't.
Right.
You have a different viewpoint on it.
When you say contrived, really, what have you got in mind, really? The characters are brought together with some difficulty, really.
So that it's like you need a staging for these characters to talk about these weighty themes.
Yes.
And every line that they talk about is about some kind of weighty theme or some kind of about the kind of the human soul, and it just seemed to be there was no real light touch to it, as far as I'm concerned. And I found that strange, because Marber's work with some people like Chris Morris from the Day to Day, and obviously his work with Stephen Coogan, Coogan in the Paul Carf stuff, and some early Alan Partridge, and his stuff has got a very light touch.
Oh yes, I think Marber himself probably felt that the humour of the what he saw as the humour of the play wasn't necessarily brought out or whatever. Right. And it may be, I suppose, partly to go back to your earlier point, really, about, you know, are these purely British films, really? And I think in Jude Law and Clive Owen, I suppose you've got two well-known kind of British character actors. Once you bring Julia Roberts and Natalie Portman in, you've got, you know, very high-ranking Hollywood stars to some extent, really.
And but in some ways, they're more convincing actors, though, I would say.
Julia Roberts and
Natalie Portman, I think, than the two British leads.
Yes.
In that particular film, at least.
Yes. I mean, I think from my own point of view, you see, I mean, because it's interesting, you talk about these weighty themes or whatever, really, you see. I mean, they are very much talking, I suppose, about sex, love and desire, really, you know. Both, you know, in the play and in the film. And the film is a pretty literal transcription of the play. I mean, there's only kind of odd bits missed out and so on, really. I think one of the things that has attracted me to it, in a sense, was, you know, we can always come back to that this later if you wish, really, but the scene in the lap dancing club, which is it's slightly tied in anyway to developments in the kind of late 1990s, you know, the proliferation of kind of lap dancing clubs, and the sort of exchange, in a way, the quite kind of naked confrontation that takes place there between Larry and Alice. And he says to her, "You think because you don't love us or desire us or even like us, you think you've won." And Alice says, "It's not a war." And I think what the film and the play does is suggest, in fact, that Alice is not correct, that in fact it is a war. It is, you know, a series of battles. It is seen as a series of conflicts. So from that point of view, I suppose it does fit in very much to the, you know, the theme of the book, in a way, really, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, necessarily what ultimate conclusion one could come to. But all of these films are dealing with, I suppose, some question about the notion of the couple or the exclusive couple. Even if it's not a same-sex couple, it could be just this idea of, I suppose, the testing of the viability, the notion of the couple.
Yeah.
I suppose hopefully if I'm writing the book, more than slightly ties in with it anyway, but chapter 4 looks, and I've tackled that, We All Know Who You Did Last Summer, which is a play on, you know, the American horror film, We Know What You Did Last Summer. And it's actually a line taken from a film called I Want Candy. I don't know if you know that one at all.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
No.
I know the film that you're talking about.
Right. It's about film students who want to, well, they're at University of Leatherhead doing film studies, and they want to make a film, but they end up making a pornographic film, kind of, well, let's say an erotic film with comedy elements or whatever. And that line about We All Know Who You Did Last Summer, it actually comes from an awards ceremony for these films.
Right.
And this chapter it's drawing a little bit on the work of Leon Hunt, really, who we both know and I think both admire. His work on what you might call the lost continent of British films in the 1970s, the sex comedies, Can You Keep It Up for a Week, Ups and Downs of a Handyman. Films that one might say treat, you know, the topics and themes of Closer, which, you know, you say found a bit heavy or a bit stilted or whatever.
Stilted would be the best
word. Right. You know, in a much lighter fashion. And the films I'd be looking at here would be, there's only really, I think, a small number of films that fall into a, you know, modern equivalent to the 70s, or not quite equivalent, but drawing upon the idea of the 70s sex comedy. And there would be Sex Lives of the Potato Man, the aforementioned I Want Candy, and a film called Dogging, a love story. And
I've heard of that.
So set in the Northeast. And the key film I would look at would in this section would be The Look of Love, a film about the life and times of Paul Raymond. Ultimately, I think a rather tragic story, but a film that for the most part is dramatised in a comedic fashion, really, drawing upon these ideas about, you know, sexual desire. And, you know, being presented more graphically, more explicitly, you know. Certainly, you know, in comparison to a film like Closer, which, interesting, you know, I mean, all the characters talk about sex all the time, but there are no sex scenes. Mm-hmm. Then chapter five would be Diary of Somebody. There would be case studies of the Bridget Jones films. Obviously, it's just a radio podcast. You can't sort of see these, but as you can see, they were promoted. You know, Bridget's back, bigger than ever. Mm-hmm. Kind of comment on her weight.
And that was for the second one, was it?
That was, yes, for the second one, The Edge of Reason, as was this one. Uh-huh. And, you know, the poster, there's Bridget Jones in the middle, there's Hugh Grant on the left, and Colin Firth on the right. And a woman director for all of these films. Sharon McGuire does two of them. Beeman Kidron does the middle film. So I think that is also something new in comparison to most of the other films in the book. You know, so it does give it you know, a new aspect. And I suppose all these films really, in comparison to the others, they perhaps play down sex in a way and concentrate more on. I suppose finding a partner for life, in a way, you know, finding Mr. Right. And one might say, I suppose, just, you know, well, how do they get so much mileage out of, you know, does she settle down with Hugh Grant or does she settle down with Colin Firth? You know, how do they get almost three films out of that? The difference of figure in the third film. So, that chapter will be exploring how Bridget, in a way, privileges the woman's perspective, really. Mm-hmm. We see things from how she views them. And it's, you know, it's an example of a modern woman, as opposed to trying to have a career, trying to settle down, ultimately, to have children, but finding it, you know, very, very difficult, finding dating problematic. And I think there is a relationship between the Bridget Jones films and these other films, which also does come in, I suppose, with this idea of, you know, is the notion of the couple forever, is this something we should be striving for, or is this something that, you know, is always going to end in some kind of disappointment? And all throughout, you know, these films, I suppose, is also they're touching on issues of society, family, bringing up children, you know, being able to find a job that will, you know, allow you to kind of fulfill your desires and so on. And there are, you know, two recent films which I'd look at, Disobedience and In God's Own Country, which are looking at kind of non-heterosexual gay relationships and the kind of difficulties that they have in flourishing in certain respects.
Where are those two films set? Those two.
In God's Country is set in Yorkshire,
right.
And it is. I don't know if the title is meant to be kind of ironic. I mean, I kind of live in Yorkshire at the moment, so I'm not entirely sure, really. And Disobedience is relationship about two women within a very strong Jewish community in North London or whatever, you know, which does not find favour with the kind of the Jewish community and so on. And throughout this, the whole book, I'd also want to acknowledge the work of Thomas Wartenberg, a philosopher who teaches film and was here for a year at one stage. And his book, what he called The Unlikely Couple. And he was very interested in couples who because they, what he called, seemed unlikely, raised a lot of questions about society and society's willingness to accept kind of difference, diversity. Ken Loach made one film about a Pakistani man and a Roman Catholic woman set in Glasgow, which raised, you know, a lot of questions about, you know, social identity, individual identity, and the number of identities that people have. You know, so from that point of view, I thought as a project, it you know, covered quite a wide range of ideas, and, you know, hopefully things that are of interest and meaning to, you know, our everyday lives and so on.
I think one thing that stood out there was the idea of back to closer, when the woman,
Natalie Portman.
Yeah, Natalie Portman's character says that you know, it's not a war, but of course then you see the scene between the two men in the office, and they make, well, Clive Owen's character makes it clear, that's one of the ways that he saw this.
Yes,
he does it in a kind of very aggressive way, and it also reminds me a little bit of the end of the first Bridget Jones movie, when the two men are fighting over her, and then there's also a replay of that in the second film as well. Like, that's the you know, there's a, I think, a comment there that you could draw a parallel.
Yes.
Maybe I'm forcing that, but I think this, it's very much about this, like,
yes,
this is the one way that the women are seen it,
yes,
the men behind behind closed doors seeing it in a completely different way. Of course, that spills out in Bridget Jones and they're fighting public in the restaurant. It's quite a funny scene from what I remember. That all sounds really interesting. So you're not really exclusively talking about comedy necessarily, or is it just the fact that,
no,
you know, would you say that in the 1990s, in your first book, Tears of Laughter, then there was a lighter kind of zeitgeist and mood in Britain, and that would have been the reason why things, or do you think it's an industrial thing, and probably the premiere film of that period would have been something like Four Weddings and a Funeral, and so for that reason other comedies were made to try and tap into the idea of British comedy being an actual thing?
Yes,
one of those two possibilities, or probably both, I would suggest.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, looking at British cinema of the last 10 years, it is more difficult to find examples of trends and traditions, really. I think there was a moment after Tony Blair was elected in 1997, and, you know, obviously Four Weddings and a Funeral comes before that or whatever, but there was a sense of new opportunities, new stories emerging in British film culture. So there were these films like Brastoff and the Full Monty, which were looking about men who were facing redundancy and you know, either having to find a new way or accept, you know, something had come to an end. There were films such as Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, and I suppose Love Actually, you know, might, you know, be the one that lives on the most in a way of these films, that were sort of saying, well, British cinema can do romantic comedy just as much as American cinema can, and that there are interesting stories, though. I mean, it was interesting, or very striking, that those films drew upon a kind of an American performer at the centre of it, really. You know, Andy McDowell, Four Weddings, and Notting Hill having Julia Roberts. And the other thing, I suppose, that was going on was films such as Bargee on the Beach, East is East, films that were very much looking at sort of Asian identities, and My Son the Fanatic, you know, a kind of comedy drama exploring all those issues. It all now seems, you know, a long time ago now, really, and I suppose this is also a sign of, you know, how Britain itself has changed. And obviously what's dominating discussions now is Brexit. So I began writing this just really as kind of Brexit was, you know, starting to become, you know, the number one issue. And I'm not sure, you know, it would have changed how I view it, but it's trying in its own way to look at how individuals' personal desires maybe stand outside sometimes, you know, all these kind of wider debates, and maybe in their own way, what they say about Britishness and Englishness or whatever. I mean, Loving a Damp Climate, Raymond Dernier's use of that title is to suggest, and he's using it as a criticism of British cinema, really, up till about the British New Wave in the late 50s, early 60s, is his claim is that it's a very emotionally repressed cinema, that it's a cinema that's uneasy with sex, and he feels that it reflects something in the society itself, really, that it's a rather... a society he feels that's uneasy with open expression, people are uneasy with each other, and has problems with love and desire, and it wants to dampen down love and desire in the same way it wants to sort of dampen down social ambition, personal ambition. And you know, obviously, all these years, all these decades later, we're in a very different kind of scenario. So it struck me as a challenge to see maybe, you know, how far Dernier's kind of claims and propositions might be seen as you know, still valid. And the other thing, I suppose, you know, that we haven't mentioned, and you know, I suppose has become, you know, something of a much discussed point as well, is the availability of pornography, not just obviously in Britain but all over the world or whatever, you know, and the implications of that for ordinary kind of filmmaking in a way, really. You know, so if we have these sort of sex comedies, you know, Sex Lives of the Potato Men or I Want Candy or whatever, inevitably they're pretty mild compared to what you can see online or what you can buy in the DVD shop. And I suppose what all these films are looking at, I suppose, is this relationship between love and sex, in a way, really, you know. And the notion of desire, that literally, I suppose, desire ends nowhere somehow, you know. The logic of it is that, you know, characters wouldn't settle down, that, you know, they would want to go on, you know, having new partners all the time. And yet, at the same time, you know, one might say, well, society depends on the idea of marriage and, you know, not least for bringing up children and so on. So I think, you know, all these films are looking at these, I suppose, challenging questions or whatever, you know.
And when is the book due to be published?
Next year. I think they're waiting to see how Brexit sorts itself out until they, you know, absolutely fix a date and so on.
Yeah. And that's Manchester University Press, and so sometime in 2020.
Yes.
Yeah. So one film we've both seen recently, which again crosses that kind of line between, is it a British film, is it not a British film,
yes,
is Fighting With My Family, the Stephen Merchant movie. And on the one hand, we can see it's, you know, quite culturally British, in that it's, you know, we've got this kind of a lot of kind of working class stuff in yes, Norwich, the use of Norwich as a location, yeah, some very British references in it, but it's also part funded by the WWE. It's got an American kind of a producer, Dwayne Johnson, who's The Rock, a former wrestler, obviously, yes, one of the, yeah, biggest movie stars on the planet. And it's a film, you know, it's partly set in America as well. Yes. Vince Vaughn's, yeah, in it. Yeah. And it's about this trajectory of a woman who wants to be a famous wrestler from kind of working class Norwich all the way to the kind of the world stage in, yeah, in Florida.
Yeah.
What were your opinions on the film, just as a piece of entertainment?
I was very impressed by it. I mean, Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian, I don't know if you read this review, he gave it a rather unfavourable review. And he talked to Vince Vaughn, who plays a kind of coach in America, kind of phoning in his performance or whatever. And I think he was suggesting that perhaps the people, I think, on the American side of the movie were not, you know, fully behind it or whatever. And it is a difficult thing that they're doing, in a way, because they have to appeal, you know, to British and American audiences, you know, so moving between them is by no means a kind of easy matter. And they do comment upon it quite nicely when they talk about her accent, don't they? And don't they think she's Russian or something rather to begin with or whatever? You know, it's certainly, I mean, you know, to us, I mean, it sounds like she's just, you know, speaking everyday English. But I did find it fascinating, this movement between Norwich, and I was never entirely sure where they were in America. Actually.
They go to Florida for the training
sequences,
yeah.
Right.
So it's in Florida somewhere.
Yes. And I thought that did raise some interesting questions about where one might feel more at home somehow, really, because the film quite boldly, I mean, the ending, you might say, is, you know, positive and affirmative, as you would want in a kind of wrestling match. But the film, two-thirds of the way through, does suggest, in fact, that this America, this lifestyle, is not what she wants. And,
yeah.
And of course, she does come back to Norwich. And I think there was a sense in the film that, like, Norwich and Florida, they obviously exist on the same planet, but they're not really kind of reconciled. And it's very striking that her family, of course, doesn't go out to visit her. I mean, you might have had a, you know, quite a different film if they turned up as well. Maybe they might have thought that, you know, which was like an episode of the Flintstones or whatever, really. But I think it was an important film because it was, in a way, suggesting that if she really wanted to be fulfilled, I mean, obviously in the particular niche thing about female wrestling that she was going in for, then it was necessary to leave Britain, to leave England. And, you know, I'm not familiar with the true life story of the person, but although the film ended, I'm sorry for giving away any spoilers to anybody who's listening, with her winning this match, which, as you pointed out, must have been kind of prearranged, this finalist match that she succeeds in overcoming the, you know, the reigning champion. But that, in fact, in the real life case of this woman was that, as I understand it, her career was over at 25, and there were serious injuries.
That's true.
And, you know, something of an unhappy life after that, or whatever. You know, Nicholas Rogue once said, you know, well, the only ending really in life and films is death. You know, and it's all a question of where the film ends at any particular point. And I think it's probably, you know, right that the film ended where it did. But clearly from the sound of it, if the you know, were to be a sequel, then the sequel might be, you know, much darker and so on. But I thought a wonderful performance from Florence Pugh, is that
how you say? That's correct,
yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with you there. I think the performances are fantastic all round, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they pitch it really quite well. I think it's got a lot of, and if we just kind of reviewing the film, we could say that it's, what would they, you know, use all the cliches, it's got a lot of heart and all that type of stuff.
Yes.
But it's got, it establishes a lot of affection, I think, for the characters.
Yes.
Despite a story which is quite, you know, it's extremely formulaic. But
yes.
I think back to what you were saying about the two different worlds, and maybe she needs to leave Norwich and leave her family to be happy. And but it also gives us both, doesn't it? Because it constantly cuts back.
Yes.
Her happiness in Florida is only dependent on because her family is happy for her in Norwich.
Yes.
And we have to, obviously, we've got the character, brother played by Jack Lowden, who I thought delivers a really good performance there, who's the brother who gets left behind, and there's some really, some dark stuff with him being an alcoholic and getting into fights in pubs and things like that. And I thought, well, his performance is excellent as well, really. And you need his as a counterpoint, the kind of dark side of what she's going into. But yeah, absolutely, it was a tragic kind of.
Is she successful because she's female, though? Because in another type of film, the brother would have been the one who goes to America, perhaps.
I think from what I know of it, I'm not a massive WWE fan, but she was one of the most popular kind of female champions at a time where any kind of helped usher in, from what I know, understand other female champions around. And maybe because of her style and her the way she looked, you know, she had her own unique kind of selling point around her, the character of Paige. And I think, as you say, the film does stop before it does get tragic, because I think what happened in real life was she had injuries, and also she was somebody released a sex tape of her onto the internet, which I read caused her some quite deep depressions, as you imagine it would. And I think she probably found that quite difficult in real life. That's what she said. So that's quite a kind of an ugly underside to that sort of fame. And there's interesting. There is a gag in the film actually where they call Vince Vaughn's character sex tape because he makes people famous. And I don't know whether that's an allusion to that happens, or it's maybe a kind of like a making light of it, not in a bad way, but kind of reference this thing that happened to her after.
Was this something that happened in America or Britain? Do you know?
All in America. Yeah, the real page. She speaks with quite a kind of mid-Atlantic accent now.
Right.
So she's almost completely lost the North.
Does she live in America? Do you know?
I imagine she does.
Right. So it's not entirely unhappy then.
Well, no. She's rich and famous. Yes. I'd read that about the about her being quite depressed after that tape was really obviously extremely private moments.
Yeah.
Were released to.
What do you make of the moment of the film when she dyes her hair blonde?
I think the film does that really interestingly, because you know it kind of sets up those three blonde ex-model cheerleader types as the potential villains.
Because I was never quite sure how we were meant. I mean, in the end, we're meant to be sympathetic to them.
Yeah.
One of them is a mother or whatever.
Yeah.
They're all quite nice people, aren't they?
Well, that's what I thought was good about it, because I think it plays on the expectations that these three are going to be the bitchy girls. That she has to fight against the media, instead they kind of they throw that completely on its head, and it's actually
literally,
and it's actually Soraya Page herself who's the one who's misread the situation, who's actually becoming cross.
It's a nice moment, isn't it, where she leaves that gift for the woman's daughter.
Yeah, and there's a little that kind of, you get those kind of training montages, which is quite good, where they're helping each other. She's helping them do the wrestling, and they're helping her do the walk, a sexy walk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I thought those scenes were really quite good.
And she gets her strength back, a bit like, is it Samson or whatever, that he loses his power, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Don't he cut his hair and then he loses his kind of invincibility. Her power comes back when she goes back to her kind
and
of dumb
hair box. Back. Yeah, that's
maybe,
interesting.
Maybe, you know, puts the ring back in her lip again. Or you know. I mean, is the film a kind of, I don't know, is it an argument for wrestling, or just an argument for having some individual goal? Maybe, I mean, wrestling in this case, but singing, I suppose, would be something about talent shows.
It's an empowerment narrative, isn't it? And all those kind of American empowerment narratives are always about finding yourself, being yourself.
Right,
you know, being authentic.
Yeah.
That's
the
kind of the if there's any kind of lesson that Hollywood wants to push, it's to be yourself and be authentic.
Right.
For better or worse.
Can you not be yourself in Norwich though, really? I mean, would that be the Norwich is just not big enough to be yourself.
I think that was one of the things that they're trying to say, that, you know, back ultimately, if you want to be a wrestler and a famous wrestler and a good wrestler, you want to work for the biggest company that there is.
Right.
And it's interesting that it is partly funded by the WWE organisation as well.
Right.
So it's clearly not going to be critical of what it's like to be a wrestler working for that company.
Because it doesn't, I mean, maybe understandably, it doesn't go into too much detail about, you know, certainly in America, how these fights are organised, really, does it? Or is any of it real? I mean, is she really kicking people or punching people?
Well, it's entertainment, isn't it? So like they're athletes, and they perform a fixed fight in front of a crowd.
Right.
And there's kind of a drama and a soap opera element.
I mean, are they all fixed or really?
Yeah.
What, all of them?
In entertainment wrestling organisations. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But doesn't this then raise a whole question about her trajectory then? I mean, it's not a triumph really, is it? I mean, it's just her face fits in the end then, is it?
Yeah, you have to be an excellent performer, I think, is what it is. But it is interesting what happens at the end, whereas the film is obviously tells us how it's fixed, and it's all about athleticism and entertaining the crowd.
Yes.
But at the end, it does try and set up this match as if it's just happened. And
this is what I was wondering.
It has a bit of sleight of hand there, which I don't think is entirely successful from the filmmaker, where they don't.
So is this final fight fixed then?
Yes, in real life it is. Yeah. But obviously, right, in the film, they all...
In the film, I mean, it's not... Well, it's not presented as a fix in the film, I don't think, is it?
They don't really mention it, because it keeps cutting back to her family watching in Norwich on the television, as if they don't know what the outcome of the fight's going to be. And maybe they didn't know what the outcome of the fight was going to be, because maybe the performers have to keep it quiet. I don't know.
Right.
But obviously, it's a prearranged kind of result.
So this is not classified as a sport, then?
I think it's, could they call it sports entertainment or something like that?
Right, if boxing matches were fixed, I mean, yeah, but Raging Bull, obviously,
everybody knows it's fixed.
I mean, that's all about that, isn't it? Right.
So you go for the entertainment and the drama and the spectacle of it, really.
Right.
Rather than you go for an actual sporting contest. It's not a sporting contest in that regard.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's difficult in the end with that final scene, with the final scenes where they have to have her winning the title, in that they make it, they try and pull the Rocky trick as if she's fighting against all odds.
Yes, yes.
But of course, you know, she's already won the battle because she's been signed by the WWE at that point.
So, right.
So the film's stuck in that it's got this...
I suppose she still has to pull this off, doesn't she?
She has to win over the crowd, yeah.
Right.
Yes. I mean, I'm happy with the ending. It's in the last 10 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
And it needs some kind of conclusion to it. And then it does it in a way that's that's quite entertaining, I think, with the whole family and friends watching back in the house. But I thought it was a pretty impressive film, actually. And I think I think it's got a lot of things going for it. And I think, as I said earlier, I think the cast is marvellous as well. Lena Headey playing her mother and Nick Frost playing her father. You know,
when she was younger, she might well have played the lead role, Lena Headey, in this, in fact, mightn't she?
I think that's right. That would have been... She's terrific in everything that I've seen.
Yes, is the film, in a way, you know, sort of like the Full Monty made a big impact, because we tend to think of stripping, rightly or wrongly, as a kind of a female occupation. You know, Closer would be an example of that. I wonder if in wrestling we also think of that as a male occupation, and that is maybe one of the things that this film does very well, is it suggests it can be a lifestyle for women as well.
I think maybe. I think also as well that the very story itself, to come from something, a place like Norwich,
yes,
all the way to the biggest stage and being the, or whatever she was, the biggest female wrestler, the most famous female wrestler at some point, that's the story. And of course, it's based on a television documentary,
right?
And the family are quite kind of characterful, and I suppose it's quite a kind of heartwarming story, heartwarming journey, really.
Yes,
and you know that the family are still doing wrestling stuff back in England.
Have you seen the original documentary then?
I remember when it was on the first on the television, and there was more than one doc. You can't actually find the original on YouTube. The last I looked, but there's another documentary that they made around about them that's on there. That's about 20 minutes long. So they interview them when they're very young and stuff like that. And, so I'm pretty sure the original documentary, which is called Fighting With My Family, will turn up again online at some point.
They're possibly trying to restrict it a little bit, possibly, aren't they?
But do you think
it did present America as still the place we British would be a lot happier in if we could get that?
Whether it's happier, I don't know, but it certainly portrays it as a kind of entertainement space, doesn't it?
Right.
It's all the whole it's about going to the big... I mean, they go to the O2 first, don't they?
That's
in London, which itself is a move from a small city to a big city.
But we don't really see any of the fights at the O2, do we? We just see a kind of...
They just do a trial.
A trial there, you see, isn't it?
And was it Peter Bradshaw, was it, who said Vince Vaughn phones his performance?
That's his very word, really. I mean, did you feel that was the case? I mean, performance, it's a subjective thing.
I like Vince Vaughn very much, and I think...
I wonder if he's just saying he's looking older these days, really. I don't know, you know.
Well, I say he's one of my favourite actors, and I think he plays it pretty well. He's supposed to be a kind of grizzled kind of character.
Yeah.
He doesn't give everything away.
And I think he does that.
And I suppose there is an element there where they need an American star in to come in and do a turn. And a lot of those films that we're talking about, that you've talked about, you know, there's the American star who comes and does a turn.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's even if it's not based around them. Like Bridget Jones, fair enough, she's playing a British character.
Yeah.
And she embodies the character very well.
Because Vaughan himself, I suppose, might feel that his role is actually a little bit limited in a way, isn't it, really? There's only so much. It's not his story, is it? We get some sense that he was a bit of a contender who, you know, maybe didn't quite make it in the end or whatever.
I think it's cruel to say he's phoning his performance in. I think if we're going to criticise anything, you would say it's maybe it's a slightly underwritten part. But the film's not about him. It's a genre film.
No.
It's a film that's about her and her family and their trajectory. And you need these kind of sacrificial lamb-style characters who can allow them, the main characters, to thrive and flourish and achieve what they need to achieve and their aims.
One thing I wasn't sure of, and obviously if you'd seen the documentary, perhaps this is clearer, but did you know like what year this was set in? Or?
I think what year are we in? 2019?
Yes.
I think it's only within the kind of last 10 years that this has all been happening.
Right.
So they don't specify a time, do they?
No.
But they do make it out as if it's contemporary. They're having Skype chats and all that type
of
stuff.
Yes, the technology is there, isn't it?
So,
although people don't spend their time looking at the phones, which, you know, is
there's a bit of fun, isn't there?
There is.
That's an interesting point. Talking about the split between Norwich and America, it's always done through the telephone, actually.
Right.
So you get those telephone conversations, and you get these kind of, I don't know, in many ways, you could argue that it's quite stilted the way that they do the transitions between America.
Right.
But I spent all that. That also maybe speaks to the kind of how lo-fi the family is and how low-key and how down-to-earth the family is supposed to be.
I
think you know that they're still doing things by the by the telephone next to the television and stuff like that.
Yes,
in a kind of council house or at least a house on an ex-council estate.
Yeah. I mean, is it a film that it is arguing, wrestling is the example it takes, but I mean, is it arguing, do you think, for people being physically active or fit or really pushing themselves to the limit, because there's only a certain, I mean, in a way it underplays the wrestling a bit, because a lot of what we see her doing is really not exactly out in the desert, is it? But I mean, it's in very hot conditions where she's training, really, as if she's in the army in a way, isn't she? I mean,
well, I think the film has definitely makes the spectacle out of the wrestling aspect of it, and there's a lot of there's a lot of wrestling in it. And one of the attractions of the film, I think, is seeing people throw themselves, and it's undeniably impressive some of the stuff that they're doing in terms of throw. And I wonder how much the cast. I imagine the cast had learned a certain amount of wrestling moves as well.
Yeah,
I mean, if there is any stunt doubling there, you know, not that I know, I've seen it twice now, and I didn't notice anything.
Well, that's what struck me about it. You see, because you would think,
I'm sure there is stunt
if she's the star of the film, the last thing they can do is really risk getting seriously injured, isn't it? Because it's kind of the end of the film.
Yeah.
But I mean, you think she is, Florence Pugh is?
Oh, she's definitely doing some stuff. There's no question about it. I mean, there's quite a lot of quite wide takes of her doing her wrestling with Jack Lowden and stuff. And I'm sure there is some stunt doubling going on, or however they do it these days. But I thought it was pretty decent. And I hadn't seen her before in anything, and I would imagine she's going to be gone to some, well, she's already gone to fantastic things. I imagine she's going to get even bigger.
There was, about a year ago, there was a modern-day version of King Lear with Anthony Hopkins. Hopkins was 80 playing King Lear. And she plays Cordelia, and Cordelia is really only in the beginning and the end of the play, but, you know, she sets everything in motion. And, you know, I didn't know the name then. I didn't connect with the lead role in this film.
And what stage was it?
It on BBC TV. There was shooting it on location, really. It was kind of set in modern London. But, you know, they kept the language of Shakespeare, and she is terrific as Cordelia. I think you're right, absolutely right about her future. The only thing I'd have a little bit of concern with, and maybe this is taking it too seriously, I don't know really, but my sister recently had a slipped disc, really, and it was an extraordinary kind of back pain, and had an operation, and touch wood, the operation seems to have been successful, but, you know, my sister didn't get this through wrestling or whatever, I don't know, just, you know.
I figured that one out.
Yeah, yeah, but she, you know, I think a lot of time, like sitting in a chair like you had in an office or whatever, but I don't know what your thoughts would be on this, really, but it struck me that what they were doing, in fact, was actually very dangerous, even if these things are staged. All these things about people landing on the floor. And, you know, obviously there appears to be some suggestion she has sustained some kind of serious injury. Is there a bit of a danger in the film in presenting this in you know, slightly light-hearted way, that it's not really engaging with that real kind of danger, you know? Or maybe you know, because, I mean, you know, it does have Dwayne Johnson, is that his name, really? I mean,
Dwayne Johnson.
You know, obviously he's known for films now, but made his name, you know, in kind of AWE or whatever. But
WWE.
Sorry, yes, this is where my ignorance is going over, isn't it, really? But, you know, it all seemed to me he was a bit of a promotion for the wrestling, really. I mean, is this, I don't know, is this taking it too seriously, too literally?
I think so. I mean, there's undoubtedly... Yeah. People get injuries, but I suppose that's the nature of sport. It's also the nature of stunt work, and it's the nature of acting. And I suppose a film like The Wrestler, the Darren Aronofsky movie, is a film that deals with the long-term implications of that.
In
that that's a man who's still having to do it. He never made it massively big. He was bigger for a short period of time. And he's suffering from injuries, even though now he's in his like 40s, late 40s and in his 50s. Yeah. And I suppose the film does mention that. When he talks about the Vince Vaughn character and what would happen to her brother if he went to, if he became a journeyman style a wrestler, he would, you know, he would get seriously injured, but he wouldn't be able to stop and he'd have to carry on. So I think the film does allude to it. But ultimately, I think, you know, I think it's, even though accidents happen, I think.
Yeah, and you've got the, you know, the conflicts within the crowd as well, though, haven't you?
With people shouting at
her. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like Brexit supporters and non-Brexit supporters, isn't it, really? I mean, there's quite a lot of, you know, I know you get this in lots of sports, not least football, but I mean, there's quite a lot of ugliness around this as well, isn't there?
It hints at it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
it
hints at it, I suppose, but I think that is as much a part of her, she can already wrestle, it's as much a part of her ability to succeed, it's her ability to win the crowd over, and embody a kind of confident persona, which she hasn't got. It's a move towards confidence, ultimately, is what the film is about.
What do you make of that scene early on, where she meets three young women? I'm not sure if she even knows them or whatever. Maybe
no, she doesn't know them.
She just sort of suggested to them. And one of them has this line, doesn't she? I mean, you know, they're trying to, her and her brother are trying to persuade these young women to go to the wrestling. And they say, how do you know it's going to be like till you try it? And one of the women says, well, you know, I haven't had rectal bleeding, but I know I wouldn't like it or whatever. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a throwaway scene, but I mean, how does that fit in with the picture as a whole or whatever, really?
I think that scene's about formulaic narratives like that have to have these scenes where people show that they're sassy or powerful. And I think as soon as those three kind of snooty girls turn up, middle class.
Right, because there is that class element, isn't there?
Then you need to show that Soraya has got a kind of she's got a balls, for want of a better word, and she you know, she's streetwise.
Yes.
Right. And I think you need to have this. You need to show that. It's almost like the scene. It's so formulaic. You could almost imagine the scene being that scene being written in after the first draft. So we need a scene to demonstrate that she is streetwise. That she's got some sass and she's got some aggression to her if pushed.
Yeah.
And you know, and she's got power in her.
Yeah.
And I just think that scene's there as part of the formula. I mean, I'm not using that as a, but the film is very, very formulaic, but I don't think that's a criticism. It does the formula extremely well.
Yes.
And it succeeds because of its formulaic.
But does it tie in a little bit with the American idea? And I suppose this is one of the things that was seen to distinguish British and American cinema, wasn't it? The British cinema, a certain kind of British cinema, things like Brastoff, Full Monty and so on, you know, they valued the idea of the community or whatever, you know, the small society.
Yeah.
Whereas I suppose there's always been this idea about Hollywood that it not always, but in the main it goes in the other direction, a kind of an individualist idea that, you know, you can make it if you try hard enough, but you've got to kind of leave other people behind. And you see what that opening scene with these three young women, it struck me that it was kind of mirrored with the also three, maybe not quite so young women or whatever, that she's kind of wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the film, implicitly or explicitly, is engaging, I suppose, with ideas about feminist solidarity, perhaps.
Maybe.
You know,
I mean, I think it's there. I don't think the film overplays that.
No.
I mean, I think I didn't get that.
No.
That as much as a sense of it.
Yeah.
I think what you're.
She has to defeat a woman in the end, though, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Somebody has to lose.
They fight against. Yeah. They fight against each other.
Women, you know. I mean. I don't know, the more thing about it, maybe more ideologically, it's all a bit suspect because the film concludes with two women fighting each other, doesn't it? I mean, is that.
Yeah, except they're not fighting each other.
Oh, they're not really. Right. Well, they are and they aren't then, really, aren't they?
They're pretending.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I suppose films are all pretend anyway, aren't they? You know.
There we go.
Yeah. But does this tie in with this Me Generation thing in a way? I mean, is that. I remember this is overreading, but I mean, the idea that. You know, she can handle herself.
Maybe this is a good place to end it. But it's interesting you say that because the character of Paige, the name Paige, she takes from her favourite show is Charmed, and the character of Paige is played in Charmed by Rose McGowan.
Is that right?
This is.
I didn't know that.
So maybe it's personal. Wow. You raise that point, and I don't think the film does play it.
Right.
But it's there.
Because he doesn't name check her, does he?
No. You see posters of her on the wall. Right. And that's, so that is there.